Right. And now, next up, I'm also very excited to have our very own Mary Beth speak on the Tradition 8. Take it away, Mary Beth.
Okay, thank you very much. And thank you to Bobby. That was very inspirational. I don't know if I can top that. I'm not supposed to be topping that. I'm Mary Beth. I'm a compulsive eater, among other things. And it's a very funny thing, but early this afternoon, I was thinking, boy, I'm really nervous about this. And then I remembered that there's a little prayer that you say that I say at another meeting. Show me how I may fit myself to be of maximum service to you, meaning to my higher power, and to my fellows, which is all of you. And that tells me that it's not all about me. So that if I don't sound wonderful or if I don't say everything perfectly, that's not what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to tell my story. I will tell you a little bit about my story before I get into Tradition 8. I am not as steeped in the traditions of OA as our other speaker is, but I have my own little slant on it and my own little experience. Tell you a little bit about my story. I don't want to do too much. I was always the kid where something else in life or somebody else was to blame. And that started when I was around 8. When I went to school, when I was in the first grade, I couldn't button my coat and the nuns would go crazy. When I was in the second grade, I never got my seat work done. I was always, 5 paces behind. I was smart, but I wasn't able to keep up with everybody else. I'm still the last person who's ready to go somewhere sometimes, but I work on that. So when I was about 8 years old, that's when my relationship with food began, and I started to use food as a way to try to anesthetize my feelings. And it sort of worked, and then it didn't. That was around the time I was getting very awkward. I'm not sure where, I think that's about the time when my father's drinking was starting to get out of hand. I was clearly looking for something or somebody to comfort me, to put a period on my life, to put a period on the night. I did a lot of night eating. I did a lot of, in the refrigerator at night. I remember my father yelling at me. And this was sort of, my story growing up. I was always the chubby kid. I was the kid when she was 16, went on the diet and lost X amount of pounds. And then I gained it back. I had lost a whole lot of weight or a good deal of weight for a 16-year-old or 17-year-old. And then I think it was New Year's Eve or something, and my parents had a party and they had food left. And I remember eating everything in sight, thinking, well, I earned this. I was Spartan, and I would restrict down to 700 calories. I was Spartan because my father wanted me to be thin. He wanted me to weigh 99 pounds. I am never, ever going to weigh 99 pounds, but that was the goal. That was the goal for dad. So it went on and on like that. Growing up, high school, junior high school, what we called it, junior high then, now it's middle school, high school, I was a mess, really a mess. I was always the kid you could guarantee would say the wrong thing at the wrong time. I wanted so desperately to be accepted and loved, and yet I would say the very thing that would make people hate me. I wanted to be accepted, and yet I would dress in such a weird way that would make me even heavier than I was and weirder than I was. I was asking to be bullied and ostracized, really. So I went away to college my second year of college, and I decided that if I get away from my father, everything will be wonderful. Nobody will know what a misfit I am, what a square peg in a round hole I am. Well, they figured it out really, really quickly. And I don't want to go into this other aspect of my growing up, but I did, when I was 19, become addicted to alcohol. And that addiction followed me for about close to 15 years. And during that time, that it didn't really replace food, but food wasn't the glaring problem. It was a problem, but not a glaring problem. And on days I didn't drink, I would up until the last year, I would reward myself with a mountain of food. and all of that kind of thing happened. And, you know, it just went on like that. I got into recovery, 12-step recovery in 1986. I was done. I was probably going to die. My liver was very borderline. But, and of course, the first month of my recovery in the beverage program, we'll say, I lost about 10 pounds. I said, this is great. But it was just the bloat. And I started to eat a little more because that's what I had now, food. And food, after all, those other things are bad. Food is nice. Food is good. Food nourishes us. I didn't see it as the big problem. I saw that I had a weight problem, but I didn't see that I had a food problem. I tried one of the diet plans that's out there, the commercial diet plans. It's a very good sound plan. And for anybody who has a little weight to lose, it's great. It's great. But for me, I couldn't adhere to it. So I had a sponsor at the time in the other program, and she was married to a gentleman in OA, and he said, why don't you try OA? And they wanted me to wait till I had a little time in the other program. And then I came in. I came in 1988. I lost a whole mess of weight. I didn't understand. I thought it was about losing the weight. I didn't understand that it was about the recovery. I would hear things like thin is not well, and I believed it, but I didn't really, really feel it in my gut. You know, it was about the weight. It wasn't about the recovery. So it became about the weight. And when you focus on the weight, you lose the recovery. You know, so I did. Of course, I put it back on, and I was in and out of OA for a lot of years, and then I was out. And, you know, even in the other program, I took step three in terms of my addiction to that particular substance, let's say, but I didn't really apply step three to everything in my life, because if I had really turned over my life to my higher power with my finances, with some silly decisions that I made, I certainly would have turned it over with regards to food, but I didn't. You know, I didn't binge the way I had because I wasn't in recovery. I wasn't as crazy as I had been, but I started with the night eating, and that, you know, I had a bout of diverticulitis in November of 2019. I think, well, this is it. This is it. I went back to OA live and Red Bank Saturday morning, which, by the way, is my home group. And I've just become an intergroup delegate of, sorry, an intergroup rep for them. And I'm learning a whole lot. Yeah, Danielle and I and Bobby, we all sit on the little committee, and I try to find out what's going on. And general services, I'll get into that in a little bit. But I really didn't. So about 4 years ago, I took another foray into the steps in my other program with a new sponsor. And I really got into the steps. And then the second time around, last summer, because I didn't stay in OA, my other sponsor said to me, I think it's time for you to go back to OA. It's time for you to look at this food addiction. And I'm so grateful that I did. My food plan is not as perfect as it was, or not as stringent as it was, but I have some recovery, because I know today that my higher power is helping me with my food as much as my higher power helps me with my alcohol. And, you know, I had in the course of my recovery in the other program gotten very involved with general service. And I do believe in the three-legged stool. So when I came back, I said, I have a little bit of time. I have 8 months. You know, it's time for me to get involved in, if I'm going to be in OA, I better go in with both feet, because that's what they told me to do. And I look at my recovery as two twin girls walking along, trudging the road of happy destiny. Not, you know, before it was, you know, my other recovery from my other addiction here. And then, you know, my abstinence. Abstinence is the most important thing in my life. Nah, it's number two. Today, they're equal. They go together because it's my recovery. You know, so I'm very honored when Danielle asked me to do this. And I've talked a little too much about my story, but that's my story and I'm sticking to it. So Overeaters Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. And our spiritual fellowship, our spiritual principle here in Overeaters Anonymous is fellowship. And you know, my husband has since retired, but he is in the other fellowship, and he was involved as a counselor dealing with people who have some of that addiction and another one. And I used to think, wow, he's violating everything. But his professionalism there had nothing to do with his member being a member of that 12-step fellowship. And that is the difference. I know that there are people who work in the recovery from food addiction. They're professionals in those particular fields, maybe as a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist or a psychologist or whatever, but they don't wear their OA hat. And that's what I did not understand for a lot of years. So, you know, the people who work, let's say at the inner group, and I know this from the other fellowship too. I'll tell you, I had just a little bit of, because I read both traditions in both books. And in AA many, many years ago, they had a problem with people saying, oh, those secretaries, those people slinging hamburgers in those clubs, those caretakers, they're not really truly AA members. They're not really in recovery. They're making money off of AA. And they used to say that. And they were not looked upon as real members in recovery. And then they realized that these people were not doing 12-step work because we never professionalize our 12-step work. That is always volunteer, but they make the 12-step work possible. So a couple of decades later, in Overeaters Anonymous, they had a similar situation. And there was an inner group and had a manager. And they wanted the manager to be a volunteer. And then, of course, you know what happens if you have a volunteer. Volunteers want to help. But then their job gets busy, their family gets busy, and they're not there. And they realize that at the intergroup level, you have to have people there to be there for the sick and suffering compulsive eater, undereater, overeater, food addict, purger, whatever the food situation is. There needs to be somebody there to make that 12-step work possible, to give that person information about meetings, about resources, etc. So the office manager's job was really too big to be handled by volunteers. So those people had to be paid in Overeaters Anonymous, just as they had to be paid decades before in Alcoholics Anonymous, because they make our 12-step work possible. If there's nobody at intergroup to put, you know, to do anything like that, you know, or world service, then we're going to have a problem. So we're never paid for the service we give in OA, but we carry the message of recovery. And anybody who's professional is always asked to take your OA hat off at the door of where you work and be that professional person. And then you leave, you put your OA hat back on, and you put that OA hat on when you go into an OA meeting, but you take your professional hat off and you keep that at the door. And that's the thing that I never understood for a whole lot of years. You know, although our meetings are really therapeutic, you know, we're not about therapy, and there's nobody who's really quote unquote in charge. So there are a lot of questions here in tradition 8 that are great. Do we try to fix other people, giving them our expert advice? Do we try to speak as experts in OA meetings and when sponsoring? Hardly could I do that. On health issues and medicine, you know, tell them, oh, you should be going to such and such a doctor, all that kind of stuff. On psychology, spiritual matters, etc. Can we distinguish, I like this very much, can we distinguish what therapists and workers in eating disorder treatments programs do from their OA sharing? And that's really, really important. Do we put anybody up on a pedestal? Oh, other OA members, especially if we find out that they have a professional credential, do we say, well, this is the professional OA recovering or recovered overeater or undereater or what have you, you know? So, and do we, and this is, I think, a very interesting question, because this was always me. I never took responsibility. I didn't take responsibility as a kid. I didn't take responsibility as a drunk. I didn't take responsibility as an overeater. Do we make other people responsible for our abstinence or other aspects of our recovery? If something goes wrong, is it somebody else's fault? You know, the husband did this, so I ate. The job did this, so I ate, or I did whatever, you know, and that's very, very important for me. And, you know, Bobby beautifully outlined about what the steps and the traditions and the concepts do, and I don't have to add to it, but I can tell you that this to me, although this is a tradition that's based on keeping the groups together, because they always say the steps keep us personally together. We have the groups that stay together in the traditions, and we have OA as a whole with the concept, but this tradition always sounds like it, almost like it's keeping OA together as a whole too for me. So that's about all I have. And thank you for letting me share my story and about Tradition 8.